Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is August 11th, 2021, and my guest is journalist and author Johan Hari. His latest book, and the subject of today's conversation, is Lost Connections, Why You're Depressed and How to Find Hope. I want to warn listeners listening with children, today's episode is likely to deal with a number of adult themes. Johan, welcome to Econ Talk.
Oh, I'm so excited to be with you. I have this slightly weird feeling because I've listened to your voice so much. I feel like I've slipped into my own iPhone. But
that's kind of
other than that weirdness.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. The book is fabulously interesting. It touches on a number of themes we've talked about here on the program. Parts of it I am not as enamored with, but all of it is thought-provoking, and the overall themes of the book are extremely important, extremely interesting. I would remind listeners, this is not a medical program. We're not giving medical advice. Take everything you hear here with a grain of at least one, maybe more than one grain of salt, but it's a very, very interesting set of topics that you've chosen to write about. So I want to start with your own personal story. You write about your own bouts and challenges of depression and your use of antidepressants. So please give listeners and viewers a little summary of your own, how you came to be interested in these themes.
Yeah, I'm really interested to hear the bits you agree with and the bits you disagree with. I welcome debate on these questions. For me personally, I think I wrote the book because there were these two mysteries that were really important to me. And every book I've ever written is because there's something I actually wanted to know for myself. There's a slightly selfish component to all of them. So the first mystery is I'm now 42 years old, and all throughout my lifetime, depression and anxiety have increased in the United States, in Britain, and across the Western world. Now, we've all seen very acutely in the last 18 months huge increase in depression and anxiety. But actually, they were rising well before that. We've now seen an acute spike, I think, for very related reasons. So I wanted to understand, you know, why is that happening, right? Why is it that with each year that passes, more of us are finding it hard to get through the day, especially when in many ways we're, you know, more materially prosperous than we've ever been? So that I wanted to understand that. And I wanted to understand it, you know, as you allude to, for a more personal reason, which is that when I was a teenager, I remember going to my doctor and explaining that I had this feeling like pain was leaking out of me and I couldn't control it. I didn't understand it. I was quite ashamed of it. And my doctor, who was a very well-meaning person, told me a story that I now realize was contained some truth, but was hugely and radically oversimplified. My doctor told me, well, we know why some people get like this. Some people just naturally have a chemical imbalance in their brains. You're clearly one of them. All we need to do is give you some drugs. You're going to be fine. So I was given a chemical antidepressant called Paxil in the United States, Suroxat in Britain. And it gave me significant relief initially. And then fairly soon afterwards, the feelings of pain started to come back. Not as acutely as they had been, but they started to come back. So I went back. My doctor gave me a higher dose. Again, I felt better. Again, the feelings came back. And I was really in this cycle of taking higher and higher doses until at the end of 13 years, I was taking the maximum possible dose you were allowed to take for a really long time. And I started asking myself, well, what's going on here? Because according to the story our culture tells, I'm doing everything you're meant to do, yet I still feel really bad. So to really investigate this, I was trained in the social sciences at Cambridge University. I wanted to use my training in the social sciences and also my experience as a journalist to really investigate this. So I ended up going on, as you know, a really big journey all over the world. I traveled over 30,000 miles. I wanted to meet the leading experts in the world about what causes depression and anxiety and what solves them. And people who are pioneering very different solutions all over the world. So I ended up meeting just a crazy mixture of people and going to a mad mixture of places, from an Amish village in Indiana, because the Amish have very low levels of depression and anxiety, to a city in Brazil that banned advertising to see if that would make people feel better, to a lab in Baltimore where they were giving people psychedelics to see if that helped. And I learned a huge amount. The core of what I learned, I think, is that there's scientific evidence for 9 different causes of depression and anxiety. 2 of them are indeed in our biology, so my doctor wasn't totally wrong and was certainly well-meaning. But actually, most of the causes of depression and anxiety for which there's evidence are not factors in our biology. They're factors in the way we live. And once you understand them, what I learned from all these places I went to was that opens up a very different set of solutions that should be offered to people alongside, of course, the option of chemical antidepressants for people who want them.
And just to make clear, a challenge in this kind of work inevitably is that depression is not visible. It does not have a chemical marker. There might be serotonin shortage and insufficiency, whatever you want to call it. But as you point out, and you'll probably talk about later, that's not what depression actually literally is. It could be correlated. It could be a totally misleading marker. But it requires a diagnosis. So the fact, for example, that the Amish have low rates of depression, they have low rates of measured depression. I happen to agree with you. You were among them for a while. I suspect they also have low actual rates. But it could be a community where it's hard to admit to having mental health issues. We know that over the last, 2,000 years of human history, there was a thing called melancholia that people were ashamed of, and certainly depression was something people were ashamed of. So the fact that depression has risen in the United States could be simply an increase in the diagnosis, but not the phenomenon. I happen to agree with you that it is an increase, I suspect, in the actual phenomenon. But I think it's important to just say that, because as eager as some people are to mark this as a disease, and it may be in some dimension, it is not like a cancer that can be bioassayed in a laboratory and then definitively defined.
I think that's really important. And I thought about this a lot in relation to my grandmother's. So my dad's from Switzerland, and my Swiss grandmother lived all her life in a tiny village in the Swiss mountains. And I loved my grandmother. She was a remarkable woman, and she lived to be 90. And if I think about my grandmother, or my other grandmother, my Scottish grandmother, who was in a very poor working class part of Scotland. If I think about my grandmother's lives, and obviously I knew them very well, my Scottish grandmother effectively raised me, that they were, by our understanding, depressed quite a lot of their lives. They were really denied opportunities. My Scottish grandmother had an extremely difficult life in all sorts of ways. They would never have used that word about themselves. Indeed, they would have strongly rejected that word about themselves. I mean, it wouldn't have made any sense to them to talk about it. Maybe towards the end of their lives, they would have known our kind of concept of depression. So you're definitely right. There's both been a rise of a kind of narrative about depression that just didn't exist in the past, or existed, as you say, in very different forms, concepts like melancholia, which are quite distinct. Also, so there's definitely been an increase in people describing themselves as depressed. There's some, often for very good reasons, there's been a reduction in stigma around these problems. So you're absolutely right. The part of the phenomenon of rising rates of depression and anxiety diagnoses is just more people describing themselves that way who would have felt that way in the past but not used those words or that language. I do think parallel, so that's, that phenomenon is certainly happening. I think alongside that phenomenon, there is a real increase. And I think we know that I think it's reasonable to reach that conclusion, although there are other reasonable people who disagree, for a few reasons. One is there are some biomarkers for depression. Actually, serotonin is not a good one. I can go into why if you want. So for example, one thing that we know, Professor John Cacioppo, who's at the University of Chicago, did a lot of good work on this. One thing we know is people who are depressed tend to experience in their sleep a lot of what are called micro awakenings, which are where you wake up slightly when you're asleep. You often won't even know you've done it. So people who are depressed tend to have higher levels of micro awakenings. And so that's one proxy measure. It's not perfect, obviously. And we do know, because he did a very good study with a group like the Amish. It wasn't the Amish. It was another group who lived very much like them called the Hutterites, sure. who are actually even more extreme than the Amish. And the Hutterites have extremely low levels of micro-awakenings. So it's not just that they're less likely to describe themselves as depressed. They're less likely to show that fairly good rough proxy for depression, which I think is why we can infer it's not just a cultural thing where they're not saying it. They're actually feeling it less than the rest of us. I think another reason why it's reasonable to infer depression and anxiety have gone up is that there are certain factors that we know cause depression and anxiety. And we know that a lot of them have risen. So let's give a really obvious one, loneliness. Again, Professor Cacioppo, a wonderful man, sadly died recently, spent 30 years studying this and demonstrated very clearly, you know, there was a long time where people thought, well, yes, depression and loneliness go together, but is it you become depressed and then you become lonely? And actually, and of course, that is true in many cases, but he proved that loneliness causes depression and anxiety. And we know that loneliness has massively gone up, and that's just one of several factors. So I do think it's reasonable to conclude there is a real phenomenon going on here of the actual, of depression and anxiety themselves increasing.
A couple things. I think we should make some distinction for listeners who are not immersed in this area. You allude to at the very beginning of the book about what it's like to be depressed. I think people who are not depressed assume that people who are depressed are unhappy. We're talking about something different from unhappiness, certainly different from, oh, I had a bad day today. We use the word depressed sometimes casually that way. But the way we're trying to use it, I think, in this hour-ish conversation is deep despair, deep pain, difficulty in going on with life, feeling of meaninglessness, of extreme darkness, disinterest in all kinds of things, getting up in the morning, living, and so on. So this is, well, I'll let you talk about that, and then I want to put a footnote on. So you go first. When you talk about depression being on the rise or loneliness being correlated with it, of course people who are lonely, if my wife goes out of town for 2 weeks, I might be lonely for 2 weeks and miss her and feel sadder than I usually do. And if I am sad, she isn't there to cheer me up. And that's not what we're talking about, if I understand you correctly.
So I've slightly shifted my perspective on this in that I used to say, in fact, I wrote that these are wholly different states. Unhappiness and depression are wholly different states. And in one sense they are, but actually they're a continuum. Now, of course, lots of things are a continuum that can lead. Falling over in the street is very different to falling off a cliff, right? They're both forms of falling. So there is a continuum. Of course, as you move along the continuum, your experience becomes progressively more extreme to the degree where it seems, and in some ways is offensive to say, oh, I feel depressed today because, you know, you lost your keys. Very different to saying, I'm so depressed, I can't get out of bed. I do think there's a continuum. I think there's fairly good evidence. The factors that are making some people unhappy are making others depressed. And the best definition I heard of this, obviously I asked huge numbers of people about this. The best definition I heard of this was from Dr. Tyrrell Harris, who is a brilliant academic psychologist here in London, who did really pioneering and breakthrough work in the 1970s into the causes of depression. Some of the most important work has ever been done on this, I think. And her definition of depression, to me, was very good, I thought. She said, look, everyone experiences hopelessness sometimes. It's a natural part of being alive. But depression is when that hopelessness spreads over your whole psyche like an oil slick, which I thought was a really good way of explaining it.
You know, I really found the micro-awakening remark as a sort of marker of this fascinating. One of the themes, I don't want to go into it in depth, but you talk about the fact that for a long time, anxiety and depression were thought of as two different things. Now, a lot of people are starting to think they're very similar and certainly are often intertwined. But I'm thinking about the fact that my dreams have been particularly vivid over the last year and a half during COVID. And it's a talked about phenomenon. I've read about it. It's not just me. And I think it's part of that is that, and I also don't sleep very well, and I don't sleep very long. And I think part of that is the fact that there's more anxiety in my life, worrying about COVID. I just moved to Israel. There's a lot of stress involved in a move across national borders. Any move and internationally is more stressful. And I suspect I'm waking up more at night without being fully aware of it, sensing a dream because I'm half awake. And I think that's a common phenomenon, especially in these times of increased anxiety about just life in general. It's a tragic time for many. Many of us, it's not been tragic. It's just been a little bit stressful. It's nothing, I was going to say, it's nothing like war. I'm sure there were parts about being in the Blitz in London, for example, that were exhilarating. If you died, it wasn't exhilarating. If you lost a loved one, it wasn't exhilarating. But if you survived, there was a certain heroic connection that you felt with others, the kind of thing we're going to be talking about today. Whereas COVID, not so much heroic parts to it. It's just there's some tragedy and your life's uprooted and disrupted, and you don't know when it's going to end, and you don't know if you're at risk, and when if you ate too close to someone with the mask off, and all that stuff, I think, weighs on us in subconscious ways. That's, sorry for that long rambling observation.
No, that's so interesting. Yeah, COVID is not as ennobling an enemy as the Nazis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You don't get the pleasure of feeling you're resisting the most evil people in the world. Although we have regressed into a kind of tribalism about our fellow citizens, which I think is unhelpful in that way. I think you're right. I think there's several really important things you said there. In terms of the sleep, a great guest for you would be Dr. Charles Seisler, who's at Harvard Medical School. He's done really fascinating work about this. He's probably one of the two or three leading sleep experts in the world. I think you're totally right about that. In terms of anxiety and depression, this is another thing I changed my mind about. So I thought they were, and indeed, much more importantly than me thinking it, academic psychology thought this for a really long time. Interestingly now, NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, is not funding so much separate research into those. Professor Robert Kollenberg is really interesting on this. Generally, because the same things that cause depression cause anxiety, and the same things that reduce depression reduce anxiety. I started to think of it as a bit like, they're like similar tunes played by very different bands. Like depression is some bleak emo band, and anxiety is more like one of those terrible like heavy metal Slipknot bands, but they're playing essentially the same tune but in different ways.
Yeah, that's the other thing I want to get at, the other footnote I wanted to add, which I thought was extraordinary, and I we've touched on this in the program, I find it so interesting. You talk about that in the DSM, the Diagnostic Manual for Psychiatry. There was a certain attempt to describe depression, and then there was this, for a long time, an exclusion of sorts, which was for grief. So if you lost a child, you lost a loved one, a spouse, particularly in tragic situations, it was, quote, normal to struggle to return to normal life in the face of that. Talk about the history of that, because I thought that was kind of extraordinary. And it, in a way, it was an opening of the door to the idea that maybe this isn't just a brain disease, but is also part of what happens in your day-to-day life.
I'm so glad you asked about this, because people generally don't ask about that part of the book. And for me, it was one of the moments when it fell into place for me, this different way of thinking. So I learned about it initially from a remarkable woman named Dr. Joanne Cacciatore, who's now arguably the leading expert on traumatic grief in the United States. And Joanne was already a professor of social work when this happened, I think. But she, her daughter died. Her daughter Cheyenne died shortly after being born. And Joanne was very struck that almost immediately after her child died, I think that day, if I remember rightly, the doctors were urging her to take drugs, to take antidepressants and sedatives. And Joanne just instinctively thought, I don't think she would have had put it so articulately then, although she may have done, the pain I'm feeling isn't a malfunction. It's not a disorder. My child just died. Actually, grief is a form of love, right? If your neighbor across the street dies and you don't know your neighbor, you feel sad in a kind of passing way. But if your child... But you don't love them. Grief is a form of love. You're grieving the person you've lost. So Joanne began to research this, obviously, later. And she discovered, I forget the figures, they're in the book, but an extraordinarily high percentage of parents whose children die are given antidepressants and indeed even antipsychotics and a huge number are given sedatives immediately after their children's death, and often for quite long periods of time. And very often, their grief is deeply pathologized by the mental health system. So she gives an example of a mother, a woman she worked with, who had a child who died in dreadful circumstances. And she told her psychiatrist that as she went to sleep, she felt she heard her child talking to her, not in a disturbing way, in a way that soothed her. And the doctor diagnosed her as psychotic and gave her antipsychotics. So Joanne began to research this and discovered there was a history that has been written about by and investigated by other people within the realm of psychology that I think is very important. So in the late 1960s, up until the 60s, there had not been a standardized diagnosis of depression that was used across the United States, right? So different doctors had different senses of what depression was. So the people who write the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the kind of Bible for psychiatric disorders in the United States, there's a kind of other equivalent in Europe, decided to do a standardized diagnosis, partly because insurance companies were asking for it, partly because it seems a sensible thing to do. So they drew up a checklist of various things, and people listening could guess what that checklist was. It was things like, you know, crying a disproportionate amount, feeling you can't go on, that kind of thing. And they send this out to psychiatrists across the United States, and they say, okay, if people match, I think it was 6 of these 10 criteria for more than 2 weeks, diagnose them as depressed and give them what help you believe is appropriate. So psychiatrists start doing this, but not long afterwards, they come back and they say, look, we've got a bit of a problem here. If we use these criteria in the way you've instructed us, we're going to have to diagnose every grieving person as depressed, because these are also the symptoms of grief. And of course, the psychiatrists who wrote the DSM didn't, that's not their intention. They said, of course, this is not what we meant. So they invented what became known as has different terms, but the grief loophole, where they said to them, okay, use these criteria to diagnose people, but there's an exception. If someone they love has died in the last 6 months, someone close to them, a relative, they're not mentally ill. It's just a natural response. Don't diagnose them. So psychiatrists started doing that. But of course, this begs the question, why is losing someone you love the only criteria, which means it's legitimate to feel terribly, terribly sad? What about if you've lost your job? What about if you're stuck in a job you hate for the next 20 years? What if you've become homeless? There's all sorts of criteria, right?
Abusive spouse, dead-end marriage, can't get married desperately, want to, can't have a child desperately. There's 1,000 aspects of life.
Exactly.
That are challenging, that lead to grief, despair, sadness, a whole range of stuff.
Exactly. And so what happened was they gradually cut, also under pressure from the insurance companies, they gradually cut back the grief exception, the grief loophole. So initially it was 6 months that you were allowed to be sad, then it was 2 months, then it was a month, and then it was just got rid of altogether. And Joanne said to me, Dr. Cassiatore said to me, I thought it was so interesting, she said, that point you just made, right, you just listed, everyone listening will agree, those are all reasons to be sad, right? Profoundly sad. And for some people will be deeply saddening.
Devastating, not devastating. Just challenging.
Yeah. Exactly. She said, the problem with that is, once you concede that point, you have to concede that context matters. That actually, it's not just your biology that causes these problems, although biology certainly contributes in many cases, but the society and your individual life circumstances matter hugely. And as Joanne put it to me, we have a system that is not built to allow all that context in, right? A different person, a child psychiatrist in Melbourne, said to me, the problem is we have a model of treating mental distress that is taken from the way we treat tropical diseases, right? So think about malaria. So we know the pathogen that causes malaria. I don't know if pathogen's the right word, I apologize if it's not, but we know what caused the biological agent that causes malaria. We know how it's transmitted. We know how to prevent the biological agent getting through, and we know how to treat the individual once it has got through. And of course, the treatment of tropical diseases is one of the great miracles of human life. I mean, think about, you know, I'm just reading a book at the moment about London in 1666. I mean, a third of the population of London died of plagues in the 17th century. Think about how different that is from our, although COVID has been terrible, how different that is. The treatment of tropical diseases is a miracle. We eradicated smallpox from the human condition. But the problem is, human distress is not like a tropical disease, right? It's not, you identify some limited biological agent, you target the biological agent, you know. So we've taken this hugely successful model of medicine and transposed it onto something where it simply doesn't map very well. It's not like that. And I think that just to say one other thing about grief, it really helped me talking to Joanne and other people about the grief exception, because I kind of realized I actually don't think it's a coincidence that grief and depression have the same symptoms or manifest in the same way. Some people would object the word symptoms there. I think, in a sense, what depression is grief for your own life not being how it should, for your own needs not being met. Everyone listening knows they have natural physical needs. Obviously, you need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clean air. If I took those things away from you, you'd be in terrible trouble. But there's also strong evidence, go back to the 1950s and Abraham Maslow, that all human beings have natural psychological needs. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You need to feel you've got a future that makes sense. And our psychological needs, not in every respect, there are many ways in which the way we live now is much better than in the past. But there are some ways in how we live, some factors in how we live, that mean that we have been getting our psychological needs met less and less. And that is, I believe, a big factor I think that's part of what we're grieving for. Think about something as basic as 41% of Americans agree with the statement, no one knows me well. It's natural. If no one knows you well, you're right to grieve the fact that you're living in a society and culture, or just living a life where you don't have any close connections. You know, now, of course, if someone dies, we can't bring back the dead. There's no solution to that grief, sadly, although we can honor the person who died and we can continue some of the things they stood for. But with these forms of grief, there are lots of things we can do. And that, to me, is the most optimistic aspect of what I learned.
We'll get to that. The point I want to emphasize, though, and we haven't really touched on this, it's extremely important, and it's our segue from what we've been talking about to this more optimistic story, is that I would never judge anyone who wanted to take a drug to deal with grief of any kind, sadness of any kind. I don't think it's not my thing. You're free to deal with the challenges of life as you see fit. Of course, I'm often paying for it in the form of subsidies through healthcare and government. But let's put that to the side just for a moment. My point is that our culture, for some reason, has encouraged people to believe that grief is abnormal. And I find that deeply shocking and unhelpful. I think grief is cathartic. I think it's part of being human. I may have told the story before on the program. I apologize if I'm repeating myself. But, you know, I had a friend who lost a spouse who'd been married maybe 70 years, a long, long time. And she confessed to me. She said, you know, I talk to him every day. And I said, of course you do. And she said, my friends say I shouldn't. And I said, I don't agree with your friends. You know, her friends were, get back, you have to get back to normal, to real life. You know, you have to cope with the fact that your husband's gone. That's not going to change. You shouldn't try to talk to him. And my view is exactly the opposite. He's part of you, always will be. Talk to him all you want. I don't know if he's listening. That's a different question. She didn't claim that he was listening. That might be considered a little bit abnormal, or maybe not. I'm not going to judge that either. But certainly it's healthy to me to continue to connect to someone you loved and were with for decades. And the idea that, okay, time to get back to normal, I view as a strange, it's not normal. Why would you pretend it's normal? You've lost someone you care about. And the story you tell in the book of the woman you mentioned just now who lost a child at birth, roughly, it's a devastating experience. It would be abnormal to go, oh, well, back to life. I'll be fine tomorrow. And if I can't be, I need a drug to help me do it, so give me one. I think that culture, I think there are things happening in our culture that are part of that. But part of it, which is what you mentioned a number of times, is that the pharmaceutical companies have an incentive, of course, for that to be the culture. Their products are subsidized by taxpayers and by other subtler forms of subsidy. And I don't think that's healthy. I think it's unhealthy, even though some would say it is healthy. That's a personal opinion.
I think that's really important. As you were saying that, I was thinking about I think you're totally right. There is no previous human society that responded to grief like this. We have no record of any society. I'm not Jewish, but I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood, and a lot of my family intermarried with Jewish people. And one thing I always envied as a child and loved about the Jewish community is the rituals around death. I remember that when I was young, one of my neighbors died, and going and sitting there while they were sitting shiva.
A 7-day period where you you isolate yourself from your regular life and are comforted by friends and relatives who come to visit. Exactly. But you're not allowed to go back to your normal life for 7 days.
Exactly. And the deep wisdom of that. And then, of course, the ongoing mourning rituals that go on for a long time after the person dies.
Correct.
Which are exactly the antithesis, indeed, of the DSM mentality, which is, okay, you've had your 2 weeks. You've been allowed to be sad. Come on now. You can see
party time.
How deeply inhuman that way of thinking is. But Joanne Cacciatore said that the woman did this, said, you know, in our society, we just do not understand human distress. And the way I came to think of it is, in a way, I think part of the core of what I learned writing Lost Connections is that we have inadequate maps of our pain, right? Over many thousands of years, the Jewish community has developed a map for the pain of grief that is beautiful and profound, and to me seems to match human needs very wisely. And what we're doing, what we've done, and of course there were many aspects of religious maps of how to think about the world that I disagree with. I'm gay, you can imagine, plenty I don't agree with. But what we've done is we've been writing these new maps. We've been telling people they are simply scientific facts. They are not. That these are highly contingent social constructs. Although, of course, there is plenty of scientific evidence for various aspects of this debate. And I just don't think they're very good maps. I don't think they work very well.
Yeah, and we'll come back to that, I think. But I want to make one more point before we go into some of the environmental or context is a better word, I think, reasons for depression. One of my favorite parts of the book, as listeners will not be surprised to hear, is where you point out, as we have talked about many times on this program, that the evidence for the effectiveness of SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, this class of drugs that supposedly works to fix a brain inadequacy, that evidence is much more complicated than it appears. And we've talked about it on the program, and when we do, people say, I've taken them for years, they've helped me a great deal. Of course, I'm sure that is the case. I'm also sure that for some people, they do very little. For some people, there's a suspicion that it actually increases the risk of suicide. So it's a complicated picture. But what's interesting to me, and I'm not going to, there's no final judgment here. But what is interesting that is, I think, a legitimate judgment is that the statistical evidence for their effectiveness was distorted, as we've talked about on the program, by the financial incentives of the pharmaceutical companies. And when you look at a richer range of evidence, the studies they didn't use, for example, when they submitted drugs for FDA approval, a different picture emerges. And I think that's just an extremely important issue. We've talked about this with Gary Greenberg. We talked about the placebo effect. We talked about it with Jacob Stenga about medical nihilism, that a lot of the seemingly gold standard aspect of clinical trials is not quite as scientific. Well, I'll just be more blunt. It's not as scientific as people believe. And I think that point is just extremely important. If they're helpful to you as a listener, continue to use them. But for you, Johan, they were not so helpful, and you dealt with the side effects for a long time. And it's a tragedy. It's an over prescription of these drugs without the impact that it's claimed for them.
My biggest problem is not actually with the drugs themselves. It's with the story that accompanies the drugs, because it is very well-intentioned to say to people, the reason you feel this way is just because there's something biologically wrong in your brain, right? Everyone who says that, I mean, of course, there are some people who say it because they have a financial motivation, as you stress. Setting those people aside, most people who say that are wholly well-meaning. The problem is, it's not a good map of people's pain. So, and if you look at the psychiatry textbooks, they all say, so in theory, everyone is meant to agree with this, there are three kinds of cause of depression. Three kinds of contribution. There are biological contributions, like, for example, your genes can make you somewhat more sensitive to these problems, though they don't write your destiny. There are psychological problems, like grief would be one, childhood trauma, all sorts of things. And there are social problems, like loneliness, financial insecurity, and so on. So it's called the biopsychosocial model. But as Professor Lawrence Kiermaier at McGill University said to me, in theory, we have a biopsychosocial model. In practice, we have a bio model. And the problem with it is, if the only story you tell people is there's a problem in your brain, what you're saying to people, in effect, and this relates back to what we're saying about grief, but goes much wider, what you're saying to people is this distress you feel is like a glitch in a computer program, right? It's an internal malfunction. And what I learned is it's much healthier and much more truthful for us to understand it, although there's certainly for some people biological contributions. It's much healthier to think of it not as a malfunction, but as a signal that something's not right. And there was a breakthrough I had in this, and I want to stress, like you've stressed, you know, there's a legitimate debate about chemical antidepressants. They helped me for a short time, then they didn't help me. And actually, in a funny way, when you look at the scientific evidence about chemical antidepressants, it's rather banal. And although the truth, although the debate is very charged, I actually think the banal truth is something that pretty much everyone you walk past on the street, not everyone, the vast majority of people instinctively know, which is, I would say, just look at three things. So depression is generally measured by, well, it's often measured by something called the Hamilton scale, which measures how depressed people are. I've always felt really sorry for whoever Hamilton was, by the way, that he's remembered primarily by how miserable we are. But so Hamilton scale goes from one, where you would be dancing around in joy, to 51, where you would be acutely suicidal, or it might be the other way around. But anyway, and to give you a sense of movement on the Hamilton scale, if you improve your sleep patterns, like you maybe need to, you will generally improve, you'll move 6 points on the Hamilton scale. And if your sleep deteriorates, like when you have a baby often, you'll go 6 points the other way. On average, over time, chemical antidepressants move you 1.8 points on the Hamilton scale. So it's important to say a few things about that. That's an average. So some people get more. I initially got more over time. I got less. Some people say that that's a little bit too low and it should be more like 2.4 points. But it's important to stress that's a real effect. That might be the thing that gets you off the ledge. You know, it's something for some people. But equally, you can see that that's not solving the problem for a lot of people. As you know from the other, I think, most important piece of research on chemical antidepressants, which is called the STAR-D trial. So there is shockingly little long-term evidence into chemical antidepressants. The best research we have is called the STAR-D trial. It's very simple. People go to their doctor, they say, I'm depressed. They're given chemical antidepressants, and this study just follows them to see what happens. And what it found is, over time, most people given chemical antidepressants do become depressed again. That's important to say, that's not everyone, but it's most people. Now, that doesn't, to me, tell me there's no value in these drugs, but it tells you we need to have a much wider menu of options, a much deeper response. Also, the other crucial fact is that a lot of these drugs can cause quite extreme side effects. 70% of men, it will diminish their sexual functioning, for example. That's not a trivial number of people. And that's just one of many side effects. For me, it caused an enormous amount of weight gain that really just fell off when I stopped using them. And of course, weight gain in itself is quite depressing. So there's a big, broad debate about that. But for me, the most important thing I learned about chemical antidepressants was saying, I remember the moment I learned this. So much of what I had been being taught by these experts fell into place. I went to interview a South African psychiatrist called Derek Summerfield. And Dr. Summerfield happened to be in Cambodia in 2001 when they first introduced chemical antidepressants for people in Cambodia. So he was there studying something else. He was just there by coincidence. And the local doctors, the Cambodians, were like, well, what are chemical antidepressants? They'd never heard of them. What are antidepressants, they said. And so he explained, and they said to him, oh, we don't need them. We've already got antidepressants. And he was like, well, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of herbal remedy.
Leaves, yeah, some tree leaf they chew on, yeah.
Exactly. Instead, they told him a story. There was a farmer in their community who worked in the rice fields. And one day he stood on a landmine and he got his leg blown off. So they gave him an artificial limb. They're good at that in Cambodia. And after a while, he went back to work in the rice fields. But apparently, it's extraordinarily painful to work underwater when you've got an artificial limb. And I'm guessing it was fairly traumatic to go and work in the field where the guy got blown up. He started to cry a lot. After a while, he just was crying so much he couldn't get out of bed. He developed what we would call classic depression. This is when the Cambodian doctor said to Dr. Summerfield, well, that's when we gave him an antidepressant. And he said, what was it? They explained that they went and sat with him. They listened to him. They realized that his pain made sense. And I had to spend 5 minutes with the guy to see why he was so upset. One of the doctors figured if we bought this guy a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this position that was screwing him up so much. So they bought him a cow. Within a couple of weeks, his crying stopped. Within a month, his depression was gone. It never came back. They said to Dr. Summerfield, so you see, doctor, that cow, that was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right? Now, if you've been raised to think about depression the way we have, that sounds like a joke. I went to my doctor because I was depressed. She gave me a cow, right? Sounds ludicrous. But what those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively from this individual and unscientific anecdote is what the leading medical body in the World Health Organization, has been trying to say for years. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, your pain makes sense. And the most effective strategy is to deal with the underlying causes of that pain. Now, for some people, it will be worth taking drugs to take the edge off. I wrote an entire book about addiction that's all about love and compassion for people who are using drugs to anesthetize their pain. I wouldn't dream of judging anyone. I would do it myself in the situation that a lot of people are in. I did do it myself for a long time. People who want to avoid having this complex conversation say that people like you and me are pill shaming or trying to shame people. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's precisely because we love those people and honor their pain that we want to have a truthful conversation that isn't about taking anything away from people. I want to expand the menu of options. We need to anything that reduces depression should be counted as an antidepressant. For some people, that will include drugs, but precisely because of the limitations of those drugs and the side effects, we need to have a much broader menu of options that's much more truthful about what's actually causing this problem.
So what we've just talked about is roughly the first third of your book. It was very powerful because of the personal narrative as well as the narratives of the people that you interviewed and talked about, some of which you've mentioned today. The next part of the book is much more radical, ambitious, provocative, which is the source of a lot of depression is the fact that we have few and the rise over time of depression in the world, especially in the West, is an increase in we could call it loneliness, but it's a loss of connection. The book's called Lost Connections. And I want to say up front, I'm deeply sympathetic to that. I think it's true. But I disagree with a lot of what you said about that, and we'll get into some of that, I hope.
Yeah.
So, but talk about some of the examples that you use and the causes. You list 9, but talk about some of the more important ones that you write about in that we've lost, the connections we've lost as human beings.
Yeah, so we touched a little bit on loneliness, but I think it's worth exploring that a bit more, though, of course, there's lots that I talk about. So Professor Cacioppo, who I mentioned before, remember one of the times I spoke to him. So there's been a huge increase in loneliness in our culture. And again, this is something we can be fairly sure of. There's very good sociological evidence. People like Professor Robert Putnam. There's a study.
There's undeniably an increase in aloneness. People spend more time by themselves than they used to. And that can be, and I think you pointed this out, that can be loneliness. Not always. And for many people, it's not. But for many people, it is. So certainly aloneness has increased, and I think loneliness has too.
So remind me just to come back to that in a sec. I'll just give you the evidence for aloneness and then come back to that because you've raised a really important distinction that was very clarifying for me when I was doing the research. So, for example, there's a study that asks Americans, how many close friends do you have or you could turn to in a crisis? And when they started doing it a while back, the most common answer was 5. And today, the most common answer, not the average, but the most common answer is none. So there's been this interesting, what is life like if you have nobody to turn to when things go wrong, you know? And I remember talking to Professor Cacioppo and him saying to me, you know, why do we exist? You, me, everyone you've ever met, why are we here? One key reason is that
tough
our
question.
Ancestors... exactly.
It's not an easy
he
question.
Didn't entirely resolve this debate, but it reminds me one time I was on BBC Radio and they... we were debating, does God exist? And they said, okay, you've got 3 minutes. I was like, yeah, we're not going to resolve this one.
And a tweet. We'll give it a tweet on top of the 3 minutes. Two tweets.
Exactly. He said one key reason we exist is that our ancestors on the savannas of Africa were really good at one thing. A lot of the time they weren't bigger than the animals they took down. They weren't faster than the animals they took down. But they were much better at banding together into groups and cooperating. just like bees evolved to live in a hive, humans evolved to live in a tribe. And we are the first humans ever to disband our tribes and tell these very extreme individualistic narratives about who we should be. And the point you made about the difference between aloneness and loneliness, I think, is super interesting. So when Professor Cacioppo, more than 30 years ago now, started studying loneliness, initially he thought, oh, well, the way you study loneliness is you study how many social connections people have, right? That seems like a good proxy for loneliness. So no one, if you ask them, do you feel lonely, no English speaker, has any difficulty knowing what you're describing and saying yes or no. But interestingly, it proved to be much harder to define at first, because it turned out the number of people you speak to every day bears very little relationship to how lonely you feel. They're not good proxies at all. And I think, well, why is that? What's going on there? And he studied it more, years of study to make this breakthrough. And what he found was, it's not how many people you speak to every day that determines whether you're lonely. It's how many reciprocal relationships you have with people that you turn to. So he gave the example, it's fun to place for me when he said, you know, look, if you've never been to New York before and you go to Times Square for the first time, not in COVID times, in the before times, you're not alone. You're surrounded by other people, but you don't care about them. They don't care about you. If you fall over, maybe someone will help you. Maybe they won't. But, you know, there's no reciprocity. So you actually feel quite lonely. Or think about when you're in hospital. You can push the button and a nurse will come. You're not alone. But you often feel lonely because there's no reciprocity. If you said to the nurse, how are you doing? Can I help you? Would you like me to hand out the pills to the person on the next bed? The nurse is going to say, no, that's not. They will reject reciprocity. What heals loneliness is relationships where you are giving to someone and they are giving to you. And it's not on a one-to-one ratio. It's just, you know, I've got your back, you've got mine. It's also why often people feel very lonely when a relationship breaks down, even while the person is still there. And a lot of us, I know I've had this experience where, you know, the relationship's breaking down, the other person is still there, you're not physically alone, and yet you feel terribly lonely because you realize that reciprocity is gone. So you're absolutely right. The reason this is so important, apart from just it's important to understand what causes our problems, for me the reason this is so important is that once you understand this, it opens up a very different set of solutions to this problem. So one of the heroes of my book is a doctor named Sam Everington. So he's a general practitioner, a family doctor in East London, where I lived for a long time, a poor part of East London. And Sam was really uncomfortable because he had loads of patients coming to him with terrible depression. And like you and me, he's not completely opposed to chemical antidepressants, but he could see two things. Firstly, that chemical antidepressants took the edge off for some of them, but often didn't solve the problem. But more importantly, secondly, they were depressed and anxious for really understandable reasons, like they were terribly lonely. So one day, Sam decided to pioneer a different approach, subsequently spreading all over Europe. A woman came to see him named Lisa Cunningham, who I got to know later. And Lisa had been shut away in her home with crippling depression and anxiety for 7 years. And Sam said to Lisa, don't worry, I'll carry on giving you these drugs, but I'm also going to prescribe something else. I'm going to prescribe for you to come here to the doctor's offices twice a week and meet with a group of other depressed and anxious people, not to talk about how lousy you feel. You can do that if you want, but that's not the point of it. I want you to find something meaningful to do together, right, as a group. So the first time the group met, Lisa literally vomited with anxiety. It was just so overwhelming. But the group started talking. They were like, what could we do? These are inner city East London people like me. They didn't know anything about gardening. But there was an area behind the doctor's offices that was just like scrubland. And someone said, well, we could turn that into a garden. So they started to take gardening books out the library. They started to learn all about gardening. They started to get their fingers in the soil. They started to learn the rhythms of the seasons. There's a lot of evidence that exposure to the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. But they started to do something even more important. They started to form a tribe. They started to form a group. They started to care about each other. If one of them didn't show up, the others would go looking for them, say, hey, what's wrong? If they had a problem, they'd try to figure out solutions to it. The way Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. Now, this approach is called social prescribing. There's lots of small studies going on of it at the moment. One study in Norway found it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants in reducing depression. I think for a kind of, there's a similar study with anxiety. I think for a kind of obvious reason, right? It's dealing with one of the reasons why they felt so bad. And you mentioned the role of the pharmaceutical companies. You know, there is a $10 billion industry to tell Lisa the reason she felt that way is because there's something wrong with her brain. And there is a $0 industry to tell her you might want to take up gardening with a group of people who care about you, you know, and form relationships, right? Now, in my view, every doctor's office in the world should have a social prescribing wing. And there are all sorts of almost everything is easier in life when you are facing it with a group. Actually, chronic pain, they've been doing social prescribing for that. It seems to be having great results. Grief, much easier in a group. It's actually weirdly reconstituting the idea of the shiver in a funny way, their grief group. And the kind of communal support you would have got from Jewish mourning rituals or just Jewish rituals more generally. So to me, that's a really important example of how when you understand the causes, it opens up a huge thing you can add to the menu. It's actually much less expensive. And the evidence, the early initial evidence, we should stress it's initial evidence and it's from relatively small studies, suggests is significantly more effective.
So listeners won't be surprised, but as a sometimes listener, Johan, you probably won't be surprised either, but the social science evidence that you use to support the claims of lost connections, I'm not the biggest fan of that work. It's experimental work in social psychology. A lot of that work has failed to be replicated. There's a publication bias issue that a lot of the work that wouldn't confirm it doesn't get published. So I'll just say I'm skeptical of some of that. For example, that inequality is a cause of depression, meaning income inequality. But I agree with your claims, not because of the research, but because it resonates with the way I think about the world, which is, I think, often how we choose really how to decide what we think is true or not, is that, again, whether one can debate the impact of lost connections on one's mental health. I don't think you can debate that we have fewer connections. You mentioned one just now. You mentioned that we have fewer friends we can turn to. Certainly, we have a lessened sense of community in the West. Certainly, we live more in urban settings where people are leading more individualized lives. Religion is on the decline. Something you didn't talk about in the book, but I think is not unimportant. Family is on decline, which mm-hmm. you didn't talk about in the book. I think those two things were my biggest complaints about the book, because I think those are not unimportant in our lost connections. Now, we may struggle to improve those. That's, I think, the challenge. If you say, well, okay, fine, maybe you're right. What do we do about it? Now, you point out in your book, you say, I'm an atheist. So now what? You know, if I said, well, God's really helpful, you should try it, but I don't believe in it. Or you'd be really great if you had a nuclear family and you could visit your grandparents and your grandchildren and blah, blah, blah. Well, most of us have chosen lives where that's not an option. And the idea that we would, and this comes up a lot in this program, that the idea that there would be policy levers that we could turn to for those things, I think is a mistake. But if we ignore those as a cause, I think we are missing some of the picture, at least. Let's put religion to the side. I'm a religious person.
It's interesting you say that, because I changed my mind on this a little bit. So it's funny. I remember one of the other things I envied as a kid about the Jewish community I grew up in is that it seemed to me for Jewish people, you can get all the benefits of religion without having to believe in God. I remember going around when I was a kid and asking a lot of the Jewish people in my neighborhood. So they'd sort of be, I could see they were very communally involved. And I would say to them, so you must really believe in God. And I remember one of them just going, no, I don't believe in God at all.
Not necessarily.
Exactly. So it seems to me Jewish people get an incredible sense of, not all clearly, but a lot of Jewish people can get, you get the community and the collective story, which is an incredible story, without the necessity, although of course a lot of Jewish people do believe in God, of a kind of supernatural belief. But I started to change my mind on this. So for a long time, so as a child, my parents were religious, and I just looked within myself and just didn't find any, it just didn't resonate with me. I didn't believe it. And then I had a period, quite a long period, where I was a kind of Dawkinsian atheist.
Yeah, kind of it's Richard Dawkins,
Who I still, yeah,
a little hard to hear, but yes. I think you meant Richard Dawkins.
Yeah, and who by the way, I think is the best science writer in the world and remains a completely, someone I hugely admire, but by which I mean a proselytizing atheist, right? I was trying to persuade people of the merits of atheism. And I found, in the course of doing this research, I lost all of my proselytizing atheism. I feel much more humble about it. Partly because, let's imagine a scenario where tomorrow everyone in the United States or Britain became an atheist and all the churches, mosques, and synagogues fell into disrepair. If I'm honest, that would be a worse society the next day, right? A significantly worse society. And the realization of that, to me, it was a gradual realization. I didn't have some Damascene moment, but although you are actually physically quite close to the actual road to Damascus, so it feels appropriate to bring it up. But
I can see the Temple Mount with the Dome of the Rock and the walls of the old city of Jerusalem from about 3 feet from here at that window.
I've never forgotten. I once got lost in Jerusalem and I was trying to find my hotel and I stopped someone. I said, oh, how do I find this place? It said to me, go to the end of this road, go right, you'll see the Garden of Gethsemane, go through there, turn right again. I was like, wait, the Garden of Gethsemane? Yeah, just go through there. I was like, what? But even for an atheist like me, it was quite impressive. But so I think in terms of there's a lot of, look, these religious practices evolved over a long period of time because they embody huge amounts of human wisdom. Does that mean I think that every aspect of them is true? Of course not. But I'm a lot more humble about the wisdom embodied in those ideas, while continuing to disagree with many aspects of it, of course, than I was before.
So I'm not a proselytizer. I'm not going to tell you that, oh, religion is the best solution. And I actually am going to disagree with you a little bit about the mosques, temples, and churches. If they all disappeared, which is sort of what they're doing now, that's not really a hypothetical experiment. The world is becoming less religious. And as you point out many times in the book, and you reference Sebastian Junger, we've had him on the program talking about tribes. Mm. We're tribal people. We're tribal animals. We like belonging. Obviously not everyone. Some people like to be in Times Square by themselves. They don't feel alone. But most of us do that every day. We're going to struggle a little bit. And if we don't feel we're part of something larger than ourselves, we're going to struggle emotionally. And I think that's a deep insight of your book. And I've suggested on the program, as have some of my guests, that a lot of what we're seeing in the world right now is a search for alternatives. I don't want to offend anyone, but the fact is that a football game, a political party, a rally, these are ways that we connect with other people for a cause that we think makes the world a better place. For a long time, religion did that. For many people now, for better or for worse, it's just a fact. It doesn't do that for them. So, not judging, again, religious people or atheists, this is a trend in human history over the last, really, it's the last 200 years, but the last 25, it's particularly accelerated, particularly among younger people. And so, you know, my view would be, if we do lose all the church, mosques, and synagogues, and whatever other houses of worship people turn to, we will find others. The challenge is you have to find good ones. And of course, religion's a mixed bag. There are things that were done in the name of religion that were horrifying, still are horrifying. I'm not going to defend that. We're not going to get into that. But the challenge is, you know, to take sports as an example, sports is kind of empty. There's no real value there. There's some artistic expression on the field. But the main value, I think, for the participants is a feeling of collective belonging. And that's nice. But the underlying principle isn't so uplifting. Art can do it. There are many ways where, you know, building a house for somebody who's lost their house, there's 1,000 ways we can work together to make the world a better place and to get, as you point out, outside of ourselves. Religion is really good at that. We're going to have to develop. If there's no reversal of this trend, I think we as human beings will look for other ways to satisfy it. And let's be honest, some of the ways, like religion, are a mixed bag. Some of them are not just, well, kind of empty, but actually kind of destructive. They rely on otherness, looking down on other people, which is the dark side of religion. It's the dark side of tribalism, right? The insight of Sebastian Junger that you talk about, which is, I think, deeply important, we're tribal. That's just the way we are. Don't say, well, tribalism's horrible. Doesn't matter if it's horrible or not. We look for it. We seek it out. We have a natural aversion to the other. We have a natural connection to the people we've defined as our tribe. So I think this conversation and I want you to respond to it. I think this is the conversation of 2021 that we have to come to grips with.
I think you're right. I think it's so important now, partly because of COVID. You know, my friend Andrew Sullivan said to me, he was talking about depression. He said, it's like we ran a collective experiment to see if your book was right. And look, depression, anxiety, and indeed addiction massively went up. But I think you're right as well, because it's also relevant because of politics. And I think in a, and the fact that this political, how would I put it? So one of the religions we are adopting in the absence of those previous religions, and the previous religion was flawed and the new religion is flawed, is politics, right? Yeah. Whether it's Trumpism, wokeism. Yeah.
And Trumpism, anti-Trumpism, they're both really serving this role in many people's lives, for better or for worse.
Exactly. And to me, so much of the political discourse is directed at the surface phenomena rather than at the underlying issues. And there are lots of totally legitimate political disagreements, right? You can disagree about levels of taxation and what the right healthcare policies are and what the right gun control or not policies are. And these are totally legitimate policy debates. I'm not talking about them. But I think so much of the rise of this very extreme polarization and rage, which is really catastrophic, is the search for extreme forms of meaning in the absence of just ordinary meaning.
Yep.
Healthy societies, you get a sense of meaning from knowing people, from them knowing you. This person got married, that person died, this person was kind to me, that person noticed that I had a haircut. All of these, the great mulch of life. What happens when you have profound loneliness and separateness is the mulch of life breaks down and people develop these extreme, the sociological term for it is parasocial relationships. It's where you believe you're having a relationship with someone you don't know. So it might be President Trump, it might be President Obama, it can be anyone, someone admirable, someone not admirable, it doesn't matter. People develop these extreme parasocial relationships, these extreme forms of commitment. Also, just your thinking can just spin off. There's a moderating effect of ordinary social discourse, where I might say something extreme and people go, oh, Johan, that sounds crazy. And I kind of think, oh, maybe that is a bit crazy. And you get lots of often the signals are more subtle than that, right? Social discourse just naturally moderates your thinking. And if you are entirely alone, your thinking can spin off in these totally wild directions. I think about the guy who went to shoot up the pizzeria that was the center of the so-called QAnon conspiracy. I think it was a pizzeria where they believed there was children being held in dungeons underneath it, or I forget the details. And you see this guy being interviewed, he seemed like actually quite a nice person. You know, he's like, I thought there were children being held there. You know, I was trying to help them. And he seemed like a perfectly reasonable person. You could just, I got a feeling, I didn't do any research on this guy, but from the little I saw, he seemed to me actually just a profoundly lonely person in search of meaning. Now, he may have had other views. I don't know about it. I don't want to comment too much on him. But just as a wider phenomenon, I do think that this phenomena of disconnection from other people, disconnection from meaningful values, disconnection from a sense of the future is producing, I don't want to be simplistic, there's many, many things going on, but I think it's one key factor in a lot of these very concerning phenomena that we're seeing at the moment.
So I wrote an essay a couple of years ago called The Lonely Man with a Gun. Mm. And a lot of these tragedies of mass murder of strangers are a lonely man with a gun. I was asked to write about it, by the way. I was asked to adapt it for a website I won't name, but they didn't want me to say a lonely man because that was sexist. And I wanted to say, but it's
despite
usually
the fact that
they're all lonely men. I'm sorry. And maybe we could learn something from that. I think we should. But it's amazing to me, and I understand it, and I'm not, I try to be, as you were suggesting, sympathetic to people who don't agree with me, try very hard, but the response to these tragedies, whether it's the pizzeria or synagogue in Pittsburgh or the nightclub in Florida, is it Florida?
Yeah.
Just these horrible, Las Vegas, the crowd in Las Vegas at the concert. The natural response of many people to that is, obviously, we have to control guns. And then the response on the other side is always, no, but guns are okay. either because I like to hunt, or I think for the Second Amendment it's important, or because I think it reduces the risk of tyranny. There are a lot of, like you said, that's an interesting policy debate. I've been in that debate many times. But no one says, what to me is the more important question, which is, why would somebody want to kill a bunch of strangers? And why did that, what kind of society has so much dysfunctionality that not only does this happen, I mean, once would be a lot. You could say once, okay, it's just a weird outlier. It happens occasionally. I wouldn't say it happens often. Doesn't matter. Occasionally is way too often. It is a signal that something has gone dark about how we connect to other people. So in this part, Johan, this is the part of your book I totally agree with. I don't like the inequality thing. I think that's that research is just wrong. But I do think that the lost connections part, and I don't think it is a, I think it's very complicated. You blame at times capitalism, the profit motive, or the workplace motives. I think it's more complicated than that. I think it's the breakdown of the family, and I think it's the breakdown of other things that in a healthy society connect us to each other. And we should be worried about this. This is not just like, oh, it's like, it's really a, it's a, it's a different version of your point, which is like, oh, here's a person whose life has spiraled out of control. Let's give him a drug. Here's a person who has shot a bunch of strangers because they think it's a meaningful act. And our first response is to take away guns. It might be a good idea, by the way. I don't agree with it, but it's a legitimate policy response. But you have to consider the underlying cause. Why would you not confront that? That makes no sense whatsoever. So the part of your book I salute and applaud and think is incredibly important, even though I don't always agree with what you think are the solutions, is that not every case of depression is going to be caused by people connecting to other people or creating the social connections we once had. Mm-mm. But it would help. It would help. And I think I want to let you close and talk about that. Again, I may not agree with all the solutions you propose, but and I think it's – I also want you to talk about the personal response a person can have, because I think that's extremely important. I don't think you're suggesting in the book that if you're despairing – oh, don't worry about it. Just connect yourself to other people. You're not saying that. Or it's easy to fix. Don't take the drugs. Go make some friends. Mm. Now, that's not irrelevant, but I don't think that's your personal or policy response. So talk about how you think we ought to respond to this. It's a crisis, actually, that we pretend is like no big deal. It's really strange. 1 in 10, I checked this recently. The estimate is something like 1 in 10 Americans are taking antidepressants. Yeah. 1 in 10?
1 in 3 middle-aged women at any given time.
What the heck?
That's 1 in 10 at any given time. So bear in mind, across a year, that's significantly more than 1 in 10.
So I don't get that. I don't get it.
And that's 1 in 10 just with chemical antidepressants. Bear in mind all the other forms of pain relief
alcohol,
that people are taking. Yeah. Alcohol, which is massively increased.
Drugs. Yeah.
Exactly. Or prescription drugs as well. So there's a few things in what you just said that I'd like to pick up on, if that's okay, because I think it's really fertile and interesting, and it connects to something I've been researching for the last few years. Just to say about capitalism, by the way, I don't want your listeners to get the wrong impression. So I'm strongly in favor of a very significant market component to the economy. We would disagree about how much of it should be the market component.
No big deal. We're still friends. Go ahead.
We're having
a civil conversation. It's wonderful.
I also think, I would say about capitalism, because some people did say about the book, oh, he's saying capitalism is the cause of this problem, which is absolutely not what I think. I think there are extreme iterations of capitalism that can make these problems worse. But of course, there are many configurations of human societies that don't meet people's psychological needs. So the Soviet Union, for example, if we think about the Soviet Union, the absolute
Cuba, Venezuela,
abyss human nightmare of communism, for example, that was not obviously not a capitalist society, and was radically did not meet people's needs and had staggeringly high levels of suicide and despair. So there are some people who say things like capitalism causes depression. I want to go, my parents did go to East Berlin when it was a communist tyranny. You might want to, I mean, they were living in West Berlin, so it wasn't, they weren't going there out of ideological sympathy. You might want to think about that. So yeah, it would be grossly simplistic and indeed foolish to say capitalism is the cause of this. And indeed, some of the fruits of having a market economy, like the huge fall in hunger,
have things
massively reduced depression. One thing that makes you miserable is not having enough food. So people, you mentioned Venezuela, people, or Cuba, people neglect those insights, the need for a market component to the economy at their at great cost. In terms of, and it's interesting you mentioned that about shooting, because I've been doing some research. I'm writing a book about Las Vegas. I'm not meant to talk about it too much, but I've been looking a lot into who was the person who carried out the, well, the worst massacre in modern American history.
Okay, so right now, hang on one sec. I'm going to interrupt you. I apologize, but I'm going to edit out that name, I'm going to, so listeners, it's just going to be blank. You mentioned someone's name. So my view on this is, if you decide you want to increase your sense of belonging and mattering by getting your name in the paper, I understand papers have issues about what they think their responsibility is, but we don't here. So we're not going to commemorate that person's name. So somebody in Las Vegas killed a lot of people. Sorry. Go ahead.
That's interesting. In general, it's so difficult as a journalist because I agree with that. I mean, I remember when Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, did that fantastic speech after the monstrous massacre in a mosque in Christchurch and said exactly that. We will not say this person's name. It makes it slightly difficult as a journalist, though.
I understand. Yeah. Hard to write a book.
Yeah. Yeah, but so I'm not writing a book specifically about him. He's a rather tangential aspect of it, but it meant that I was researching some aspects of him and his life. So this, well, let's call him the killer in Vegas. It'd been fascinating to research him because I think, and obviously you never want to generalize from individual cases, and obviously I never met this man, so I'm just using this slightly as a bridge to talk about another aspect of this. But so it's clearly the case that this killer was profoundly socially alienated. He appeared to have no friends. I also think it was another aspect of his story. So people who don't remember, he rented a room at the Mandalay Bay and he smashed a window and he shot down a country music festival and he shot 520 people and 59 of them died. The death toll just went up because someone died a few weeks ago, if I remember rightly. As monstrous an attack as you can imagine. And of course there's a legitimate aspect of the gun control debate, and I think even I believe the figure is the majority of NRA members believe that we should ban bump stocks, which he was using, which are weapons of war. Anyway, park the gun debate, because everyone knows that debate, and I feel like it's rather sterile and there is nothing that I could add to that debate. The killer was both profoundly lonely but also was a manifestation of another aspect of the causes of depression and anxiety, beyond dystopian and grotesque manifestation, that I suspect we might disagree on slightly, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on it, which I think is a kind of corruption of values that has taken place. So the way I try to explain it in the book is, everyone knows that junk food has taken over our diets and made us physically sick, right? And I say that with no superiority. There was literally a McDonald's bag the other side of the laptop on which I was speaking to you. And we know that what happens is that junk food appeals to the part of us that needs nutrition, but actually doesn't really meet that need and in fact screws you up. But I think there's some evidence that a kind of, and I believe this is actually highly compatible with a capitalist worldview, that a kind of junk values have taken over our minds and made us mentally sick. And that for thousands of years, philosophers have said, if you think life is about money and status and showing off, you're going to feel terrible, right? That's not exactly how Confucius and Schopenhauer put it, but that is basically what they said. But nobody,
or Adam Smith,
exactly.
People, it's in the Bible. A lot of smart people have said, "Whoever gets the most toys wins" is a bad motto for life.
Exactly, and Adam Smith, I think, is one of the greatest writers about this. Actually, The Theory of Moral Sentiments is really a masterpiece on this question. But weirdly, nobody had scientifically investigated what Adam Smith and Confucius and all these other people said until an extraordinary man I got to know named Professor Tim Kasser, who studied this question and he discovered he discovered loads of really important things. But for the purposes of this conversation, I think he discovered two quite important things. Interestingly, it was not through experimental psychology, which, like you, I'm rather skeptical of. It wasn't primarily through that. It was primarily through sociology, really, just studying long-term trends. And anyway, that's a separate question. But he basically discovered two key things. Firstly, the more you think life is about money and status and showing off, the more likely you are to become depressed and anxious. It's a significant effect. And secondly, as a society, as a culture, we have become much more driven by these junk values throughout my lifetime. And I think in a way, I was always struggling between how radical what he said, what he discovered is, and how banal it is, right?
Right.
It's incredibly banal. No one listening thinks, if I said to you, are any of you going to lie on your deathbed and think about all the shoes you bought and all the likes you got on Instagram, right? No, you're going to think about moments of love and meaning and connection in your life. But as Professor Cass put it to me, you know, we're geared to not think that way. And the killer in Vegas, whose name we won't say, is a very extreme manifestation. This is a man who was obsessed. He was originally based in Reno, obsessed with, it's interesting, he was a video poker player, which is the most isolated and lonely form of gambling. Because I've been spending a huge amount of time in Vegas, no one looks more miserable than the video poker players. I've spent a lot of time observing them. It's the loneliest form of gambling. You're not even, you know, you're playing against a machine, right? You're blankly playing against a machine. He would sit there for 10 hours a day, blankly playing against the machine. But he was in it partly for the winnings, but actually mainly for the perks. So the people who knew him say, oh, it was the, he was in it for the, you know, the comped rooms, the people who make a fuss of you, the kind of simulation of social life.
Yeah. Of mattering, belonging, feeling important.
Exactly.
Dignity.
But he did also really care about the money, actually. So there was this combination of these two things. So it's the loneliness and the corruption of values. And then what happened is, of course, the way the whole system works is they'll comp you while you're spending, but when you stop, obviously the comps stop, right? So he leaves Reno and comes to Vegas. And the best theory about why he carried out this massacre, and I'm indebted for this to a documentary maker called Ram Dennison, who interviewed the killer's brother in great detail. I'm hopefully going to interview the killer's brother as well, but he interviewed him in detail, was basically he was enraged that these benefits had been withdrawn from him. He believed the folly of Vegas. And he wanted to massively harm MGM, who owned the Mandalay Bay. So he carried out the massacre partly because he was going to kill himself. It was obviously a form of suicide. But also, he wanted to carry out this massacre because it would cause tremendous financial harm to MGM, who he blamed for withdrawing these perks from him. And in that monstrous, limited sense, it did do a lot of harm to MGM. So he had a sense of how to achieve his goals. And achieved his goals. I mean, he achieved them at the expense of brutally murdering people and horrifically traumatizing many more. But I think it's a kind of illustration of these... he's an illustration, yet another illustration. I'm going to read your essay because I'm really interested in this question. You know, a profoundly... You know, it goes a bit too far to say this, but Krishnamurti, the Bengali philosopher, said, it's no sign of good health to be well-adjusted to a sick society. And you think about a society that establishes the idea that, you know, you should be alone. You should spend most of your time interacting through screens. You should think about yourself primarily as an isolated individual, not as part of a group. Insofar as you have a narrative for yourself, it should be about earning money and spending it and displaying it on screens to make people jealous. Those aspects of this society are sick. There's many hugely positive aspects of our societies as well. And I'm very glad to be alive today. So don't misunderstand me. It's an aspect of sickness. And every society's had an aspect of sickness. So we don't want to be falsely nostalgic about the past or overly pessimistic about our present, because I think that would not be right. But I do think... we need to think more deeply about these problems, and the single most important breakthrough we need to make is to understand that our pain makes sense, that we're feeling this way for reasons. And you're right, there's a trivial way in which this can be read. And as you know, obviously I very carefully do not offer this trivial reading in the book, but some people who hadn't read the book sort of accused me of saying you can imagine a glib iteration of saying this. Okay, so your pain makes sense. So, hey, if you're feeling down, why don't you just go to the shop and befriend the first person you see? Or why don't you just think differently about
your
values?
Build a garden with a bunch of friends.
Yeah. Exactly. You can see that there's a... And Lisa, think about Lisa, who was the person who I talked about, who was prescribed to that gardening program. She could not have done that on her own. It took that medical, and I'm putting medical in inverted commas, medical intervention for her to do it. So, and think about the parable of the cow, right? What those Cambodian doctors did not say to the man who was crying all day is, oh, okay, you're sad because, you know, you got blown up in this field and your leg hurts. Okay, we've told you your problem. you solve it, bye, right? The community, having understood the problem with more complexity than we would, the community together, it wasn't the doctors who bought the cow, it was the village. People chipped in the village, bought the cow for this guy. So it's about, once you understand the problem in a deeper way, that opens up a broader range of solutions. Now, I suspect, as we know, you and I would differ about the role of the state in that. But even just opening it up without proposing state-based interventions opens up community-based interventions. If you don't understand why you feel bad, or worse, if you have an inaccurate story about why you feel bad, you will be trapped. You will likely be trapped. Not in every case. Some people will just make a natural recovery. But you'll be more likely to be trapped. The more we understand these problems truthfully in relation to the best science and the best wisdom, you know, I mean, there's nothing in Lost Connections that isn't in the Torah, right? They're pretty much.
These are old values, right? Yeah. They're very old. And I think the challenge is how we get there from here to a different set of values than the ones maybe that we have. I think it's way too easy to blame it on capitalism or advertising. We're human beings, we're flawed, and we struggle to overcome our flaws. And we used to have a set of overarching values that came from religion or family or our nation. Most of those are gone, and there are good things about that. We both recognize that, but they're not being replaced. I don't think the place I disagree with you is I don't think there are too many people who are the prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, of profit. I don't think even economists understand that it's not about how much money you have. I think there's a tendency to overvalue it because of the way we conceptualize human well-being. That's a long another conversation. We'll put that to the side.
But don't you think I think there's some truth in that, but I think of it in a more primal, almost mythical way. I was just watching with my godsons The Searchers, the John Wayne movie. You think about the vision of John Wayne, right? I'm obsessed with John Wayne movies. I think he's amazing. Which is not popular on my side of politics, but I have to be honest about it.
Whatever.
You think about the primal image of John Wayne as this lone cowboy, you know, in the wilderness, which is a very primal idea in our culture.
Agreed.
Even the cowboys were not, I mean, any cowboy would have died if they'd done what John Wayne did, right? It was completely impossible to do that. That is a myth in the truest sense, right? The actual cowboys were not individualists. If they had been, they would have all died. Yeah. So you think about these very primal ideas we have in our culture, which is that, you're absolutely right, go deeper than the idea of the profit, much deeper than the idea of the individual profit motive. It's this idea that it's also almost the grammar of our thought. There was an interesting person I interviewed for the book that, again, helped me to think about this. She's a woman called Dr. Brett Ford, who I interviewed in Berkeley. She's now in Toronto, who, as part of a big team, did this really interesting research. They wanted to figure out if an individual decides they want to be happier. Let's say that you were going to say, I'm going to spend 2 hours a day trying to be happier. Would it work? And they did this research in four countries, in the United States, Russia, Taiwan and Japan. And what they found at first seemed really odd. In the United States, if you wanted to be happier, if you consciously tried to make yourself happier, in the main, it did not work. In the other countries, if you consciously tried to make yourself happier, in the main, it did work. And they were like, well, why would that be? What's going on? When they looked at it, what they discovered is, in the United States, if you tried to make yourself happier, sure, this would be true of Britain as well, in the main, you do something for yourself as an individual. You work harder to get a promotion, you buy something and display it on social media. You do something individualistic. We have an individualistic conception of happiness. Turns out that just doesn't translate to actual happiness very much. In the other countries, of course, there are exceptions on both sides. In the other countries, in the main, if you tried to make yourself consciously happier, you did something for someone else, your friends, your family, your community. So they have an instinctively collectivist idea of happiness. And you asked about which does work, works better. And you asked about personal things that people can do. And of course, I argue in the book for some bigger social changes. But for me personally, the biggest change, and it's in some ways embarrassingly small, and in other ways was a real, has had a real effect on me, is when I feel down now, I don't ever feel depressed like I did before, but when I feel down now, before, a lot of the time, I would try to deal with feeling down by an individual external achievement. some impressive, showy thing. And of course, I still do that a lot. I'm talking to
Don't
you,
we
right?
All. Don't we all?
But what I also try to do more is I've realized that even when I don't feel good, you can usually make someone else feel good. And in a profoundly lonely society, often you can do that just... Look, I'm not Oprah. I can't turn up and give people a car, right? But what I can do is turn up, leave my phone at home and listen to them and just sit there and be present and tell jokes and laugh or listen or help them think of solutions or just sit with them in their pain if they're in pain. So I try to deal more with my pain and distress by being present with other people and trying to do something for someone else rather than for myself. Now, I don't want to act like I'm some self-abnegating person. I don't even wouldn't even claim I do that 50% of the time when I feel bad. But it's become a bigger part of my personality than it was before. And for me, in line with the research by Dr. Ford and other people, that really has helped me. You know,
again, I think that's a well-known truth. I don't think you need research to do that. Mm. I'm not sure it's. I don't believe. I strongly disagree that America versus, say, Russia has or Japan has different effects of that because America is a more individualistic society. Individualism should not preclude being engaged with others, right? And I think that's a misunderstanding of the American ethos or the classical liberal ethos that I espouse philosophically of limited government. It doesn't mean we're on our own. It means that we voluntarily choose to interact with others and create a civil society. And we do that in many, many ways. We do that through family, and we do that through community, religious and otherwise, neighborhoods. All those three things in America have struggled to be sustained. Now, you could argue that's because of our individualist ethos. I don't think so. I think it's a more complicated – I don't know the answer to it. But
my point is there's
a correlation. There's a third factor that I think is driving some of these cross-national comparisons, which is family, community, fill in the blank. I think a lot of societies in the East, certainly in parts of the West, are much more family-oriented, much more community-oriented. But I don't think it's a philosophical or an ideological issue. It's an urban, rural. There's so much going on there. So I just think it's a mistake to judge this as a – to pick a phrase you don't use, I don't think, maybe once, some kind of neoliberal phenomenon of political ideology. I don't think that has anything to do with it, personally. But of course, I would say that because it would be damning for me or my worldview if it were. So I understand, I recognize that that I may have some issues here. But I do think one should be open to these other social trends that are happening at the same time cross country that I think make it hard. But let's close on this optimistic note. I'll let you have the last word. You can comment on that too if you want. Connecting to others is a really good thing. It has nothing to do with capitalism, nothing to do with ideology. And you can do it in family. You can do it with friends. You can do it in a club. There's 1,000 ways to do it, but they clearly are a source of meaning for all human beings, almost all. There are exceptions, but almost all human beings find those interactions meaningful. And I think we've lost a lot of those interactions for a whole bunch of complicated reasons. And I think it would behoove us to use a word that's out of fashion that I like to use about once a year. It would behoove us to think about how to rebuild some of that connection. And we would disagree over the role the government might have, I think, in creating those connections. I think government unintentionally, government doesn't have intentions, but individuals who've used government have unintentionally pushed it in directions that I think have been harmful to some of those ways that we connect with others. But I think that's the bottom line. What you said is not banal or trivial. The way we find happiness in life is by doing good, either to ourselves or with others or to others, listening, giving, smiling. There's 1,000 ways you can bring a little bit of brightness in the day. It's the biggest cliche of all time, but it's true. And that's why it's a cliche. It's true.
It's funny because it's both a cliche. I remember... I think you just put that beautifully. And there was this, I remember the night before my book came out, I said to one of my closest friends, you know, I'm really proud of the research I've done. I think there's really important stories in this book and a lot of things people will learn. But I think the reaction of most people who read this book will be, this is really banal and obvious. Did we really need a book to tell us all this? And then the book came out and I kept being introduced in interviews people would say, well, now we're going to speak to Johann Hari, who's written an incredibly controversial new book, right? And I remember that when it started happening, I was just like,
why?
This is really weird. And I remember one interviewer, I think it was for NPR, said, I was talking about, again, what I think is the most, and we've only covered a small amount of what's in the book, but I was talking about what I think is the most obvious point in the book, which is loneliness makes you feel terrible, right?
Yeah.
And I remember I was talking about how loneliness causes depression, and the interviewer said to me, well, this is a very controversial argument. And I remember thinking, this is insane, right? Yeah. And I think I said, I can't remember if I said it at the time, but I sort of said, if we could go back 60 years and say to your grandmother or my grandmother, do you think being lonely will make you feel worse? Right? My grandmother would have clipped me around the ear and said, why are you wasting my time with such ridiculous questions, right? Yeah. So what we've been talking about, I think we have very similar instincts on this aspect of it, is in a very peculiar spot where it is both banal and radical, in that there's nobody, very few people, if we stop them in the street and, you know, kidnap them and force them to listen to this podcast, would disagree, I think, with large parts of what we're saying. And yet, we have been trained to think about problems like depression, anxiety, and addiction in a radically different way, right? I mean, I've had conversations like this with people where you'd say to them, okay, do you think, when my book was controversial, when it came out, I remember speaking to some of the critics, and I said to them, do you think loneliness increases depression and anxiety? Yes, I do. Do you think if you've been abused as a child, makes you more likely to be depressed and anxious? Yes, I do. Do you think financial insecurity makes you more likely to be depressed and anxious? Yes, I do. What causes depression and anxiety? A chemical imbalance in your brain, right? So we're in this weird, it's true cognitive dissonance where people hold two sets of insights in their mind at the same time and don't see the contradiction. But the problem with it is we know these things, and yet we do not, and yet we have systems to respond to this problem, depression, anxiety, which is a real, terrible, agonizing problem, that ignore pretty much all of those insights and have a wholly different narrative. Now, it's not that narrative doesn't contain some truth. Like I said, I believe in a biopsychosocial model. There are real biological contributions to these problems. Some forms of drugs can take the edge off for some people. But we've allowed that insight, which is a small part of a much bigger picture, to eclipse essentially the whole picture, to dominate the whole, A, of the medical profession's response to these problems, but B, a huge amount of the cultural conversation about these problems. And we've created this extraordinarily defensive discourse where anyone who argues, like you and I do, for a broader conversation is treated as if they're saying to everyone, I'm going to go into your bathroom cabinet, take your Prozac and burn it, right? Which is not at all what we're arguing for. Or worse still, we're going to come into your bathroom, tell you you're a bad person for taking Prozac, which is the antithesis of what we believe, right? So it's really interesting to see what seems, I'm always interested in arguments that are both obvious and very controversial, because then that suggests to me that it's gone to something quite deep in the culture. There's some tectonic rubbing in the culture. If those things are true, because very few people dispute what we're saying, right? I mean, you'll get some people who say, and they may be right, I don't think they are based on my reading of the science, but you'll get some people who say to me, you know, some really admirable people, Dr. Andrea Cipriani, who's at Oxford University, Professor Cipriani, I should say, who's a great person, who says, look, you're right about all the social causes. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but you're right about all the social causes, but you underestimate the value of chemical antidepressants, right? They're more useful than you
maybe
think.
Yeah.
Maybe right. I don't think he is, but although I do think they have somebody, but he may be right. Those are legitimate debates. But it's interesting to me that what we're saying is reacted to as controversial, which is precisely why we need to have these conversations and why we need to have them in these non-polarized ways. And I think you're totally right what you said before. This isn't just a fault line about depression and anxiety. I mean, those are huge enough. Like you say, 1 in 10 Americans are taking chemical antidepressants. But this isn't just a fault line for that debate. This is a fault line for so much more. A profoundly lonely society that connects to the wrong things and has values that are going awry in many ways is going to be a society that has dysfunctional politics, that has that just has a huge amount of pain in it that could be preventable. We can't prevent all human pain. You know, many parts of the human condition are tragic, but there's preventable pain here that we could be dealing with.
My guest today has been Johan Hari. His book is Lost Connections. Johan, thanks for being part of EconTalk.
Thank you so much. I meant to say, my publishers tase me if I don't. Anyone who wants any more information about the book, or more importantly, you can actually listen to audio of a lot of the people we've been talking about, the experts, or you can find out where to get the audiobook at www.thelostconnections.com. And I've really enjoyed this conversation. I really enjoyed the spirit of entering into this conversation. And we need much more conversation like this. And I'm really worried that the culture is moving in the opposite direction of everyone screaming at everyone else. And it's horrifying.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.